Richard Conniff has written about animals and their natural habitat for National Geographic and Smithsonian Magazine for more than 20 years. He has also been writing features about the wealthy for magazines such as Architectural Digest. Going back and forth between these two worlds, he realized that his subjects had more than a little in common, from mating rituals to dominance behavior. Conniff decided to explore the kingdom of wealth, much as a zoologist would explore the animal kingdom. His book is called The Natural History of the Rich, a Field Guide. Among other things, Conniff says the rich act like animals when giving away so much of their money in the name of philanthropy.
What I like is a comparison with a bird called the Arabian babbler. And this is a bird that actually uses philanthropy to establish a social hierarchy and to maintain status. And what happens is that the dominant individual will find a worm, and instead of gobbling it down himself, which would be the sensible thing in the desert, he goes and he finds a beta, and he makes the beta beg. The beta actually has to crouch down like a nestling, spread its wings, sort of put its mouth up gaping, and then the alpha takes the worm and shoves it down the beta's throat. And when he's done, he sort of lifts himself up and he gives this trill, almost a purr, which reminds me of a socialite at a charitable ball posing for an event photographer.
So you draw a parallel here to, you know, Ted Turner's amazingly large gift to the UN, for example.
Yeah. Well, you know, Ted Turner is a great example of one style of dominance. He spent most of his career dominating aggressively in the fashion of, say, an alpha baboon. I mean, he used shouting, he used glowering, he used sheer physical presence, and also this kind of maniacal indifference to consequences to get his way. But it didn't necessarily get him dominance in some areas. So when he made this gift, he was having his sort of ancient rivalry with another media titan, Bill Gates. And he switched from aggressive dominance to dominance by being nice, which is really a much more sophisticated way to obtain dominance. He announced this gift. It was the largest single act of charity by a human being in history at that point. And it was also pretty clearly a bid for dominance, much like the trilling of the Arabian babbler. And if anybody doubted it, he actually took a cut at Gates at the time that he announced the gift. He said, you know, you may have a lot of money, but it doesn't do any good if you don't know what to do with it.
You have an interesting description of dominance behavior among men in your book. On page 72, could you read that for us?
Sure. In shallow pools along the shores of Lake Tanganyika lives an odd little fish, a type of cichlid. In this species, subordinate males are poor, harried creatures, sexually undeveloped, with drab, female-like colors. But when a subordinate usurps a dominant individual, the newly anointed alpha male almost instantly turns bright yellow or blue. Over the next week or so, he experiences an eightfold increase in the brain cells that produce a key chemical governing sexual development. He acquires the cichlid equivalent of cojones. He also lays on muscle and sports a flashy red tip on his dorsal fin, like a pocket handkerchief in a double-breasted suit. In fact, the happy cichlid does everything possible to apprise rival males of his dominant status, except put on epaulets and war medals. He does everything imaginable to attract females, short of standing on his tail and fish lip syncing Barry White's "I'm qualified to satisfy you."
That's wonderful. Did you have someone in mind when you wrote that?
A lot of people. One of the things that you see consistently in the natural world and among the rich is that dominant individuals tend to get more sexual opportunities. Jack Welch, the former head of General Electric, he's a short man, bald, and he said that having money was like standing 6'4" and having a full head of hair. You get lots of dates with attractive women.
You talk about risk-taking also, and in nature you argue that animals survive not in spite of the risks they take, but because they're willing to take risks. Is the same true for the wealthy?
I think it is. This is actually a pretty perverse idea that's developed over the last 20 years, and that is that something can be good because it's bad. So, for instance, out in the Serengeti, an antelope, finding that it's being chased by a cheetah, doesn't necessarily run for the hills as fast as it can. What it will do if it's a strong animal is leap straight up in the air. It's a behavior called stotting. And what this does is demonstrate to the cheetah that this is a really fit animal. It's a way of saying, hey, don't even bother chasing me. You just won't catch me. And the predators tend to recognize this, and they go after the ones that don't stot. So, I think that there's a tendency to demonstrate how fit you are by taking risky behaviors, by going up in a balloon like Richard Branson or Steve Fawcett and trying to fly around the world, or by going up in a fighter jet like Larry Ellison, or also, in Ellison's case, sailing a yacht in a race where people are dying because the weather's so bad.
Among the wealthy, there are great divisions among old wealth and new wealth. In the animal kingdom, are there similar divisions among the newly dominant and the old guard?
Well, the analogy that I make is with gorillas. When you have a group of gorillas, a lot of females gathered around a male, and then a new female joins the group. The other females try to freeze her out. They are appallingly rude to her. They pig grunt at her. They harass her and inhibit her reproduction. And it can take her years to fit in. And I think that any nouveau riche who's ever tried to cut it in high society will know exactly how that feels.
You note that one of the rituals that is so commonly associated with the rich, the air kiss, actually
yes.
dates back to primates.
Well, we tend to think that this is a modern affectation. You know, you pooch out your mouth and you part your lips with that sort of moist clicking or chirping sound, and you say mwah, mwah, into the air beside one another's ears. But primatologists call this lip smacking. In chimpanzees, for instance, what it is an imitation of grooming behavior, where an animal reaches in with its mouth and picks insects or dirt out of the hair of another individual. So when chimps lip smack from a distance, what they're saying is, I want to groom you. I want to be your friend. You can trust me. And we say the exact same thing with the air kiss.
I will never view an air kiss the same way again. Because you do write about the rich and powerful for publications such as Architectural Digest, have you had conversations with any of the people who are profiled either directly or indirectly in the book? And what is their take? Are they a bit offended by this?
When I was going around doing this work, a lot of rich people loved the idea as long as I was talking about other rich people. It was kind of funny because I would ask them something, they'd say, no, that doesn't happen here. And then as I was going out their door, the assistant or the housemaid or somebody would take me aside and say, that's exactly what happens here.
Well, what's one of the reasons this book is just so juicy is because you name names.
Yeah, I do. Well, that's really half the fun. I mean, it's kind of interesting to take people who regard themselves as most aloof from the natural world and show really how intimately their lives are connected with animal behavior.
I'm not sure how many dinner invitations you're going to be getting following the publication of this book, but Richard Conniff, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
Richard Conniff, he's the author of The Natural History of the Rich, a field guide. We'll be right back.